The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, brought to you by SUP China. Each week, we bring you a roundup from the world of business in China from Caixin, China's authority on business and financial news, as well as interviews with Caixin Global reporters and editors. I'm Kaiser Guo from the Seneca Podcast.
And I'm Ada Shen in Paris.
First, a look at this week's news. Chinese discount shopping site Pinduoduo made a strong debut on the NASDAQ last week, following a $1.6 billion IPO that was one of the biggest listings by a Chinese company this year. Backed by social media giant Tencent, Pinduoduo is the latest to join a rush of sizable Chinese listings overseas this year. So far, 26 Chinese tech companies have sold $9 billion of new shares through IPOs, including household names such as video sites iQIYI and Bilibili, and online medical services platform Ping An Good Doctor. Pinduoduo's flotation has been warmly received. The company priced its IPO at the top of the range and was oversubscribed 20-fold from investors that included Fidelity and the sovereign funds of Abu Dhabi. Launched in 2015 by ex-Google engineer Colin Huang, Pinduoduo uses a bulk buying business model. It is noted for its group purchase system that encourages buyers of groceries, electronic devices, and other goods to invite friends to join in shopping to get discounts. In just 3 years, Pinduoduo has become China's third largest e-commerce company in terms of sales, challenging behemoths Alibaba and JD.com.
A man set off a homemade explosive device outside the U.S. Embassy in Beijing last week, injuring only himself in what Beijing police have called an isolated public security incident. Police said the man was a 26-year-old from Inner Mongolia who, citing his family and hospital records, has had hallucinations since 2016 and who was diagnosed with paranoid personality disorder. The police accounts could not be independently verified. The explosion caused a period of chaos, and a swarm of social media posts showing the aftermath had netizens wondering what had happened. The outside of the U.S. embassy is often busy with Chinese citizens lined up waiting to enter the facility for visa services.
Huawei saw its share of the domestic smartphone market soar to 27% in the second quarter, the highest share for any brand since 2011. Huawei brand Honor accounted for 55% of its total shipments, an increase of 33% from last year, showing Honor is gaining momentum within the Huawei portfolio. Honor was originally launched in 2013 as a cost-effective smartphone brand targeting young Chinese consumers. It made its first international foray a year later and has since expanded into higher-end phones. Oppo was the second most popular brand in China in the second quarter, followed by Vivo and Xiaomi. Apple came in at number 5, with its share dropping year-on-year.
China is set to introduce a cooling-off period for divorces to address a spike in the rate of separations. Under draft recommendations released last week by the Supreme People's Court, judges would be able to impose a waiting period of up to 3 months on couples who fail to settle on a divorce out of court. The Supreme Court argued that couples could use the period to mediate their differences and obtain counseling services. But some have argued that this just makes divorce more difficult and may infringe upon the country's marriage law. This would be China's first nationwide cooling off period. Such measures have already been used in regions such as Sichuan, Fujian, and Guangdong provinces to counter a trend of divorces that authorities say are over trivial matters or have been filed impulsively.
China has sentenced a former top banking regulator to 16 years in prison for accepting tens of millions of yuan in bribes. Yang Jiacai, a former assistant chairman of the China Banking Regulatory Commission, was sentenced by a court in Henan for taking bribes and amassing enormous assets that cannot be accounted for. Yang reportedly took bribes worth $3.5 million and kept another $4.5 million of unaccounted-for wealth when he served in senior posts at the Central Bank and the CBRC from 1998 to 2017. Yang, who worked in the Chinese financial regulation system for more than 30 years, was in charge of key CBRC departments such as human resources and the general office before he was placed under investigation in April 2017. The first official to fall within the banking regulatory system, he informed on 9 other CBRC officials and 8 employees of financial institutions, sources told Caixin.
Zhu Jun, a household name in China and venerable CCTV host, has become the latest prominent figure in the country to be accused of sexual assault. A former intern on Zhu's show posted a lengthy account on social media platform Sina Weibo of how she was assaulted by Zhu 4 years ago. The post went viral, but was quickly taken down. Zhu, 54, is one of China's most famous TV hosts, known for his signature sentimental style in interviewing celebrities. He is also a longtime host of the Spring Festival Gala show on CCTV, China's state-run TV network. Hundreds of millions of Chinese ritualistically tune in to watch the show on New Year's Eve. The intern's story emerged as the Me Too movement reached a new height in China this week after a number of well-known figures were accused of sexual assault or harassment. Many of them are public intellectuals or NGO activists who have been viewed as champions of progressive values. The allegations of sexual misconduct sweeping China's civil society come after the emergence of the Me Too movement abroad and after months of similar reckonings in the country's education institutions, implicating a number of academics, including 4 members of China's prestigious Changjiang Scholars Program.
China's school children are overweight, have poor eyesight, and don't get enough sleep. Oh, and they need to focus more on creativity and analytical skills. That's the takeaway from the country's first comprehensive study on the quality of its mandatory education system. Researchers from the Ministry of Education tested 500,000 fourth and eighth graders across China from 2015 to 2017 and found that the vast majority performed well in language and math. However, many showed weaknesses in areas that require more critical thinking and creativity, like data analysis and scientific inquiry. They also called for China's schools to address the shortage of teachers and lack of well-rounded physical education, citing the high prevalence of obesity, poor eyesight, and sleep deprivation among school children. 15% of 4th and 8th graders are overweight or obese, researchers said. Over half have moderately to severely impaired vision by 8th grade, and a whopping 83% get fewer than 9 hours of sleep a day, recommended for middle schoolers by China's Education Ministry.
Speaking of China's primary schools, they are getting crowded quickly, and the trend is largely being driven by the shuttering of rural schools. The number of elementary schools in China dropped nearly 6% last year, continuing a decline seen for more than a decade. Authorities closed thousands of schools either because families had relocated to more urban areas or to more easily manage their student populations in cities. China's now defunct one-child policy and the migration of huge numbers of citizens to cities have contributed to the dwindling number of students in rural areas, researchers said. But while the number of schools declined, the total number of students rose, reaching 100 million last year, meaning classroom sizes have swelled, increasing concerns of so-called superclasses in which up to 70 students are taught in one classroom in some cases.
Let's turn now to some of Caixin Global's reporters and editors for a more in-depth look at some of the stories in the news. First up is Fran Wong, economics reporter for Caixin Global. Fran, China has been in the midst of what you might call a crackdown on its asset management industry, which means obviously that there's a lot of money at stake. And China has been concerned about, transparency, of course, and it's worried about debt. So a couple of months ago in April, Beijing said it would be introducing measures to reduce shadow banking and off-balance sheet lending and to bring a bit more transparency to the industry. But of course, when you do that, it sends some jitters through the industry. So I think a lot of people were waiting on clarification on what the new measures were going to include, what direction they were going to go in, how fast the regulators were going to move, how tight things would get, and so forth. So finally, we got some news. Tell us what that was all about.
The latest development is that the central bank, the banking and securities regulators on Friday published a series of new rules clarifying and complementing the regulations introduced 3 months ago. Interpretation by the market is that although they're still maintaining the ultimate goal to reduce the debt levels in the financial industry, authorities are also ready to slow down the pace of the crackdown due to concerns on economic growth.
So Fran, how do we think the market has reacted so far? Is this going to calm some of the fears in the community?
Because since the initial rules were introduced in April, a lot of lenders contracted their lending activities, which has fueled a spike in corporate bond defaults and stock market rout. The clarifications provided are expected to help boost investors' confidence and might also ease the pressure on companies to get credit or to refinance their debt.
And finally, why do you think the Chinese government decided to put the brakes on the crackdown to slow things down?
Why they are indicating they can slow down the pace a bit is because of rising uncertainties of economic growth due to trade tensions with the US, which risks dealing a heavy blow on China's exports. Several sources close to policymakers told Caixin that this could be related to the trade war. They said the trade war disrupted the recovery plans in many countries, and it's very likely that China's three-year battle against risks will have to be postponed or will have to be extended.
Well, Fran, this is obviously something you all will be keeping a very close eye on, so we look forward to having you back again to chat soon.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, and thank you. Next up is Doug Young, Managing Editor of Caixin Global. Doug, as usual, we'll talk about two stories. And the first is about the fate of a huge chip M&A deal. What's the story here?
The story is about one of the biggest microchip mergers, or would have been one of the biggest microchip mergers in history, probably the biggest. There's a company called Qualcomm, which makes the chips that are used in a lot of our smartphones. And they were trying to buy a Dutch company called NXP, and the price tag was $44 billion. So the story is basically, every market in the world had cleared it. These things always have to get antitrust clearance to make sure, you know, they're not going to get to be too big and strong and monopolize the markets. And usually the US, Europe, Japan, a lot of these big markets, they have to sign off and give it the green light. Well, this deal was announced about 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, and pretty much everybody, these deals usually close in 6-7 months. But this deal, 2 years later, was still waiting for, guess what, China to sign off on it, because China also is an important market for these guys. And China had just been dragging its feet forever. And the news this week was that the two companies had basically been extending a deadline for the deal to close again and again and again and again. China just wasn't cooperating. And finally, they just said, enough. We're not extending the deadline anymore. They made the final deadline, and China just didn't give its approval, basically scrapped this deal.
So is this Chinese stonewalling different in this case than in the past with how they've handled other deals?
Well, I think it's not even just for deals, but just China, again, they make promises all the time, and then they just don't do anything. And this is one thing that's constantly frustrated the business community here. They're always complaining lack of access, even though China always says, we'll do this. And even, you know, for people like you and me, our visas, they say, oh, we're going to make life easier, and then they just don't do it. Or they do it and they make it impossible to go. So what was interesting this time is I think the whole world was watching, and China really got a bit of a showing up that, you know, this is not the way you do things. If you say you're going to do something, you do it. And if you reject something, you give a reason why. And you move on. You know, not everyone's going to agree with you, but you don't just stay silent and do nothing. And actually, in this case, after the deadline passed and the two companies said, we're not going to pursue this anymore, China did sort of come out with a tail between its legs kind of statement saying, well, we're still open to trying to resolve the differences, you know, sort of after the fact. So the deal may not be dead. Maybe they'll come back and try and test China. But I think Qualcomm had said previously, you know, just that in the current political climate, this deal just isn't going to happen. So I'd be surprised if they come back.
So, Doug, can you quickly summarize what you think the rationale was for Beijing in this Qualcomm NXP deal? Why it might be that the rest of the world seems to have been okay with the deal, but China had qualms?
Yeah, I mean, what was going on? I think there probably was some real antitrust concerns. You know, China is actually Qualcomm's biggest market in the world. I think it accounts for more than half of their sales. And NXP, I don't know the numbers for them, but I'm sure it's a very large number as well. So there probably were some real antitrust concerns. But I think what was happening here was rather than work with these companies to try and address those concerns, China was just like, resubmit your plan. This doesn't help us. And then they weren't working with them to try and get through things, which is what, you know, most other countries would do that. They would say, we're concerned about X, Y, and Z. If you sell off this, do that, and then this, we'll approve it. Because all they're worried about is maintaining competition. And just China didn't seem to be working with these companies to try and make this deal happen.
Let's move to your second story, which is about chocolate. So you have my full attention. What's the news?
Yeah, this is basically Hershey. You and I are both from America. We all know Hershey. They're sort of synonymous with chocolate. Not necessarily the best chocolate, but hey, they're chocolate. They have been trying to push their brand of chocolate in China. And probably about 5 years ago, they bought a company called Golden Monkey, a local Chinese company. They actually paid a pretty penny for it. They paid about $500 million. So the news is now they've quietly sold off this company. I think they're trying to not have to tell anybody, but they finally fessed up when some people realized it. And so we can say this Golden Monkey turned out to be a bit of a clunker for Hershey.
Do we know how much they sold it for?
They are not saying what they sold it for, but I would be very willing to bet it was a significant loss from what they paid. Again, they paid $500 million, which is quite a bit. So
Doug, maybe put this in the context of the broader candy sweets industry and tell us what you think is going on here.
Yeah, I think there were two things going on here. One is, like you said, the bigger sweets market has sort of, it's always been a tough market. Chocolate in China has always tended to be sort of almost like a gift. People buy it to give to other people rather than to consume it themselves. And that whole market has sort of peaked. I think chocolate sales, they were growing okay before, but now they've sort of leveled off. So that's one thing. Just Chinese have never really been as into sweets. And we've talked about this before with donuts. They have a hard time there too. There were also some company-specific issues, and this is just sort of classic foreign acquisitions of Chinese companies. They buy the company for the product, but they don't realize they're also inheriting, you know, a whole culture and a management style, and you know that's probably going to be quite different from their own because it's a Chinese company, probably a state-run background. And apparently there was a lot of talk that there were culture clashes and Hershey started laying people off, and you know, it just sounded like it was probably pretty ugly behind the scenes. Sales were going down. You know, it was probably a no-brainer in the end for Hershey to dump these guys.
Well, thank you, Doug, and we will talk to you again next week.
Okay, thanks, Kaiser.
And that's this week's show. Thanks for listening. The Caixin Seneca Business Brief is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Tanner Brown with stories from the staff of Caixin Global. Thanks, of course, to Ada Shen. Special thanks to Li Xin of Caixin Global and to Spring and Autumn and Wu Fei for the music. Check out the latest podcast in the Seneca Network, New Voices on Women and China, as well as our flagship current affairs show, Seneca. And be sure to follow the news from China every day at SubChina. Sign up for our free email newsletter at subchina.com. Take care.